Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
AT&T connects an ode to podcasts. Connect the alarm. Change the podcast you stream. Connect the snooze. 10 more minutes to dream. Connect the shower. Lather up with the news. Sports talk, comedians, or movie reviews. Connect with that 3-hour philosophy show. Change the drive into work in traffic so slow. Connect the dishes to voices that glow. Thank you to the geniuses of spoken audio. Connect the stories. Change your perspective. Connecting changes everything. AT&T.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and it's Saturday. Time to go into the old vault. This time we're following up the episode that played last Saturday, so we're bringing you the Voynich Manuscript Part 2. This was originally published on September 5th, 2019. We hope you enjoy.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and we are back with part two of our exploration of the Voynich Manuscript, or the Voynich Manuscript, we've been saying both. This medieval manuscript that has fascinated scholars, cryptographers for decades now, or actually not just decades, for centuries, but especially since it was reintroduced to the world around 1912 and has become the subject of intense interest because it is full of this text that has not been successfully decoded if it is in fact a code, or has not been translated if it is in fact a language, accompanied with these amazing, strange illustrations of alien plants and women bathing in these strange horns with crocodile tendrils. Is this absolutely captivating document that is in a library at Yale now. And today we wanted to go further by exploring the history of people trying to understand this document, to come up with a theory of its origin or to explain what it says, if it says anything.
Yeah. So again, definitely listen to part one if you have not.
Absolutely.
This is definitely a part one, part two scenario.
Yeah. I think you'll probably be very confused if you try to jump in the middle here. So go back to part one first. I thought we should start off today by separating the different theories of this manuscript into two basic camps. And then within these camps, there will be different theories. But the two main camps I think we should look at are signal theory and noise theory. And so signal theory looks at the Voynich manuscript and proposes that there is some underlying meaning to the text, that it could at least in theory actually be translated to yield a signal or a message. And of course, it's not necessarily saying that we have understood what the message is or that we ever will understand what the message is, but at least in theory, it could be understood. It says something. That's signal theory. Noise theory, we would say, proposes that there is no underlying message. It's just gibberish, whether intentionally or unintentionally.
Yeah, and indeed, that does cut to the chase. Either this is a document that means something or it means nothing. And both are kind of enthralling possibilities. One is filled with wonder and gives way to all sorts of conspiracy theories if you gaze into it long enough. And the other is kind of equally terrifying, that this thing that has captivated and just and overwhelmed so many, intensely intelligent and in many cases, very well educated individuals, it could ultimately be a work of nonsense. That it's just, it's kind of like just pure chaos.
And there could be multiple reasons why it could be a work of nonsense, or at least nonsense to us. And I think we'll explore these individually. But first, I think we should look at some of the possibilities for understanding this document under the signal theory, the theory that it actually does say something. So what would some of these explanations be?
Well, one of the big theories is the cipher theory, the idea that the text is protected by a letter-based cipher. It's a very popular approach to trying to figure out what's going on with the Voynich manuscript.
Right. So the idea could be that it's something like a letter substitution system.
Right.
So these characters that we don't recognize, the, roughly maybe 15 to 25 or up to 30 characters that are used to make the words in this book somehow correspond to letters in a known language or letters in some coded language or something like that. That there's a way of breaking the code and it can be retranslated into an actual language.
Yeah, getting into the idea here that it could be in a code and it requires a code book. And since we don't have the code book, it's the cryptographer's goal to try and figure out what the code might be.
Oh, okay. So a code book could mean that it wouldn't even necessarily have to be a straight like letter substitution type cipher. Mm-hmm. It could just be that there are, known translations of certain word forms or something like that to other known words.
Right. Another possibility is that it's written in some form of shorthand that we have, lost understanding of. There's also the idea of steganography. This is the idea that the text itself is meaningless, but key signs would indicate hidden useful information, like little details on the illustrations or the text itself or some combination. This would be kind of like, a cheap spy novel version of this is like counting the dotted I's on a page,
right?
Sort of thing.
And that tells you something. Right. Sure, yeah.
Another variation that's brought up is that you could obtain the necessary info by placing a plate over the page with spaces in that plate to reveal the important characters.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So this would be, like one of those, decoder ring kinds of thing.
Yeah.
Oh, no. That actually I think is letter substitution. Okay. But there are codes like this in toys and stuff that you can buy that like you put a plate over, it's got certain holes on it and you read the letters that appear in the holes.
Right. And it's my understanding that if those plates were random enough, that in and of itself could make it extremely difficult, if not impossible, to crack the code, of the Voynich manuscript.
Sure. But then there are other theories that are less about code and that might still present to us as codes, but maybe it wasn't intended as a code.
Yeah, like a big one is that it is some form of natural language that has been forgotten. And various possibilities from Eurasia have been presented.
Yeah. So the idea here would just be we've got no other documents written in this language or written in this transliteration of the language.
Right. And then another idea, to come back to something we discussed in the last episode, is that it could be a constructed language.
So like a language that somebody made up on purpose, like Klingon or Dothraki, but the 15th century version of that.
Right. Now, another intriguing idea, and this was apparently presented by Jerry Kennedy and Rob Churchill, that it could be what is called a glossolalia.
Yeah.
So this would have been essentially like a work that is a stream of consciousness work that is created via speaking in tongues, similar to the work of Christian mystic Hildegard of Bingen.
Yeah, and this would be, I mean, you could look at it as a form of automatic writing.
Right.
You know, that so there could be a, this could be a weird transcription of spoken glossolalia, like speaking in tongues, or it could be a written version of it directly. It would be kind of weird if it was a transliteration of sounds made orally by glossolalia into a script that didn't exist anyway. But you can imagine it certainly being like automatic writing of some kind. People, the spirits are writing through my hand. And I think that would mean in this case that while it might not be meaningless to the person writing it, it would be meaningless to any reader. So I think this would fall under the noise category, right?
Yes.
That there would be – there is no way to understand what this says because there is no underlying signal.
Because in this case, presumably the context for the piece would be – very personal, mm-hmm. and then also would probably deal a lot with personal reevaluation of the text.
Right.
You know, it's almost like less than a dream journal mm-hmm. in a way, you know, where the dream is not even taken and put into the form of language, but like the dream is in language.
Yeah. It'd be like if you had a dream journal, yeah, where you never translated it into any real language. You just made notes about your dreams in random other symbols
yeah.
that don't mean anything to anybody else.
And then, of course, another big idea is that it's simply a hoax.
Right. That it doesn't mean anything. There's no encoded signal. It's just noise because somebody was intentionally trying to create an object that would maybe confuse people or trick them or maybe just trick them into thinking that it did say something.
Right. And if that is indeed the reason for the origin story for this document, then it is still succeeding. It has probably succeeded remarkably well because if it is a hoax, it is still tricking people to this day.
Yeah.
Another idea is that if it were a hoax, if it were a completely fraudulent document, you could also make a case that it was a way to try and make a quick buck off of occult fanboys with a lot of money, such as the Holy Roman Emperor who purchased it.
So we know it was sold to Rudolf II, we think around 1586. That's when the historical records indicate. But the carbon dating of the vellum says that this parchment, at least, was probably produced in like the early 1400s. Now, maybe we think it's possible the parchment, the vellum sat around for a long time before it was made into mm-hmm. this document. But if you think that the creation of the pages on which it was written was sometime close to when the document was written, then it would have been written long before there was a chance to sell it to Rudolf II. So it would be hard to imagine that it was created specifically for that purpose.
Right.
Now, one of the things is that people have tried to do various kinds of statistical analysis of the text to say, okay, even though we can't translate it yet, does this look like a natural language? Does it look like it could somehow be decoded to or translated to a natural language? And I would say that the answer there is inconclusive. There are pieces of evidence pointing both ways, right? Like one commonly cited weird feature of the text that really makes it look like not a natural language is the fact that in some cases words are repeated in line up to three times in a row. Is that normal for a language? Is that normal, normal, normal? Not really, really, really.
I mean, I don't know. Poetically, lyrically.
Shanti, shanti, shanti.
I mean, we can all think of examples from songs and poetry and writing where
That's interesting,
you know, something may be said three times to add emphasis. But I mean, I'm not the expert commenting on this. Though this does
it's saying Sunday, Sunday, Sunday.
This does remind me, though, of when I was a kid, sometimes I would like try and create like documents that looked like they were, you know, magical documents in another mm-hmm. language, you know, with weird runes. And actually, I do that still sometimes, like doodling, you know, in the corners of a page if I'm supposed to be taking notes on something. But I, even as a kid, I would look back at what I had done and I would realize, like, this doesn't look like language. Like, it doesn't. Like there's not enough variety in the little sigils that I've concocted or something mm-hmm. that I just essentially pulled out of my head there.
Right.
It's not matching up with what one would expect from any kind of writing or coded writing system.
Yeah. So I mentioned in the last episode there was a good article about this from 2011 in Skeptical Inquirer by the German computer scientist Klaus Schmee, who I think he looked at a lot of the statistical qualities of the text from a cryptography point of view. And it seemed like he said, yeah, there's evidence both ways. And we can continue to talk about some of that evidence as we go on in the episodes. One interesting claim I came across, I'm sorry that I feel like I can't evaluate whether this is a correct claim or not, but at least it's a claim that's made against the noise theory or any theory recommending an interpretation of nonsense, is that the document at least appears to follow something called Zipf's Law, which concerns the statistical distribution of words in natural languages. So basically, Zipf's Law claims that in any natural language, the frequency with which a word is used will be directly proportional to how high it ranks in the ranking of most common words. So the first most common word will be used twice as often as the second most common word, three times as often as the third most common word, and so forth. Now, this isn't exactly law in like the physical or mathematical sense, but it, for some reason, it does appear to hold true for all or almost all natural languages. And so if and the document appears to match this. So like if you look at it from a Zipf's Law distribution, it lines up pretty close. So if the frequency count of words in this document follows this law, if that claim is correct, meaning it has a similar distribution of words to real documents in real languages, that seems to make it a little harder to believe it's just total nonsense generated by, out of somebody's head.
Yeah.
Another thing is that different words appear with different frequencies in different sections. So remember, we've got these different sections of the document, like the astrological stuff versus the herbal stuff. And so you have some words that might appear in the supposed astrological section, but not in the plant section and vice versa. This would, I think, be expected if these were written in a real language with a real message. Like you would probably expect the word star to appear in the astrological section but not in the plant section. So just looking at the symbols, the frequency distribution of symbols and how they break out and how well they resemble a real language, it seems like it can push us kind of in both directions. We don't get a clear reading from either way from that.
And again, this just comes back to what makes this document so mysterious. It's so resistant to unraveling. So a number of theories have been put forth for the origins and the true nature of the text. So much so that in 1978, when an American cryptologist and computer programmer, Mary DiImperio, composed the Voynich manuscript, An Elegant Enigma, for the U.S. military.
Yeah.
This was commissioned by the U.S. military.
Hey, cryptography, I mean, that's of massive state importance.
It is, yeah. So this is not like some sort of weird, you know, Area 51 type of shenanigan going on here. But in this this paper, which is readily available online, you can find a PDF of the full thing, she admits that she, quote, unwittingly retraced the steps of all my predecessors, rediscovering their sources, repeating their experiments, growing excited over the same promising leads that excited them, and learning only later that all these things had already been tried and had failed often several times.
Ugh.
And I found that to just be very, very fitting because this does seem to be a theme. Certainly in the last century.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's not hard to see why. Again, this is like it's sort of the holy grail of decoding, right?
Yeah. Yeah, so it's the Mount Everest of code breaking.
If you could crack it, you'd be like the hottest, code cracker in the world.
Yeah. And so code crackers have taken a shot at it. Linguists have taken a shot at it. Various scholars, all manner of scholars, amateurs, and of course, outright quacks.
Oh, yeah. This
have taken their hand to the Voynich manuscript.
I think we alluded to this in the last episode, but the internet is full of people who claim to have decoded the Voynich manuscript to the point where when we were preparing for the episode, I mean, a lot of these were just like, somebody in the last year or two has published a YouTube video or an article somewhere where they're like, I did it. I cracked it. Here's the answer. And I'm like, I don't know. Maybe one of these people actually did, and it just hasn't really been analyzed or reported on yet. I have no way of knowing because I don't have an expertise, obviously, in the relevant fields. So I can't evaluate it on my own. But it's funny, like there are so many people trying and claiming to have done it that somebody could have done it and we might not even know for a while because it would just get lost in the sea of all these claims.
Yeah. All right. On that note, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we are going to discuss the possibility, pretty much discredited possibility, that Roger Bacon actually had a hand in creating this.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. A-S-T-E-P-R-O allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use this directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon. Just $25 a month, every month. Taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
All right, we're back. Time to talk about Mr. Bacon. Now, you remember from the last episode, it came with a certificate of authenticity originally when Rudolf II, the Holy Roman Emperor, bought the Voynich manuscript for 600 ducats or ducats. It came along with a letter that said, oh, by the way, Roger Bacon made this.
Yeah, and according to Josephine Livingstone, who wrote a really nice piece in The New Yorker about this, actually a couple of pieces. One was kind of a follow-up where she talked about just internet fascination with the Voynich manuscript. She points out, that this does not seem to be the case. Though it was a kind of a popular idea for a while, or it was like repopularized in well before the carbon dating actually took place. But one William Romaine Newbold, a professor of intellectual and moral philosophy at the University of Pennsylvania, he argued in favor of the Bacon origin, believing it to be an anagrammed micrographic shorthand that required transposition, abbreviation, and microscopic notation.
Yeah, his method, from what I've read, was a little over the edge. I mean, it's like he was like looking inside the characters to see little micro like strokes of ink that may have indicated actual letters or abbreviations of word phonemes. And so his method of decoding it, which he claimed was successful, was incredibly complicated.
Yeah, but he claimed that he had translated, and he provided all these details, like drawing it into various other writings and ideas of Bacon. And he was apparently a brilliant individual, but no one could take his solution and reproduce the same results using these methods.
Right. It required so many subjective judgment calls about what he was seeing on the page in these micro notation marks and what that was supposed to correlate to.
Yeah. Medievalist John Matthews Manley, one of the Army's chief cryptologists during World War I, concluded that the, quote, decipherments were not discoveries of secrets hidden by Roger Bacon, but the products of Newbold's own intense enthusiasm and his learned and ingenious subconscious.
According to Schmay's article in Skeptical Inquirer, Newbold's translation had revealed that Roger Bacon already had a telescope in the 13th century, predating the known invention of the telescope in the first decade of the 1600s by like centuries, and that Bacon had used this telescope to discover the spiral structure of the Andromeda Galaxy.
Oh, wow.
It's just hard to believe, though, that like you could generate text that complex, just by subjective interpretations of tiny things. And then, of course, as we're saying, like nobody else could come up with the same translations based on what he had. So I don't know. It just seems like he was looking for the text he wanted to find, almost like right. Like it spells like Newbold is great.
Yeah. Another great, interesting, insightful description of this incident with Newbold comes from Terence McKenna.
Oh, yeah.
Who wrote about the manuscript for Gnosis magazine in 1988 in what is, by the way, a purely historical, linguistic article that has nothing to do with any of his writings on psychedelics.
Though I can absolutely see why McKenna would be interested in this subject, because it's this manuscript that seems to sit at the intersection of primitive science and magic and plants.
Yeah. This particular article is you can find it online in PDF form. It's also collected in the Archaic Revival. It is dated. It's 1988, so it was written prior to carbon dating. But he sums up the Newbold case by saying, quote, "The problem with all of this was no one else could extract the same plain text using Professor Newbold's method. It involves so many choices from pools of letters at every given point along the way that one could demonstrate that hundreds of different messages could be extracted from the same passages. Newbold died a broken man, disgraced, his career shattered. He had gone too far, and the Voynich manuscript had claimed its first victim."
Right.
Now, McKenna is not actually arguing that there's a curse on the document or anything here, but
I think he does get a little magic-y with it later on.
Some
of his talks. I listened to him give a lecture talks about it.
Yeah, in this particular paper, he doesn't really tie it into any of his more spiritual, shamanistic ideas. It's ultimately pretty straightforward, though, again, a dated piece because of when it was written. But he does touch on this idea of it claiming its first victim on a pattern that one sees to this very day in Vonage research. Mm. It draws so many people in. And certainly while there are quacks and conspiracy theory makers in the mix, you also see a lot of very intelligent, educated, and disciplined people diving into the text and initially claiming victory, only to realize that they too have failed to see through its mysteries, and in some cases are kind of broken on the manuscript again.
Yeah, McKenna also tells, I wish I could remember the name of this, but he tells an anecdote. I don't know if this is one of the commonly circulated stories about the translation attempts, but he tells an anecdote about this one aging scholar who was in his 90s who claimed to some colleagues to have cracked the code to, mm-hmm. you know, to understand what it says. And then when somebody was trying to follow up with him about that, they were like, okay, we'll fly down to meet you. But by the time they got there, he had died of a heart attack.
Yes, yes. That's something he relates in the Gnosis piece as well. So whatever information that expert may have had, it was lost with them when they died.
Well, I think the implication is that the expert had not actually solved it and just happened to die right in time to not get found out.
Yeah. Certainly the more likely scenario, given everything that we've discussed here. Now, I mentioned John Matthews Manley earlier, the World War I Army cryptologist. Mm-hmm. Well, he ends up turning Army cryptographer William F. Friedman onto the manuscript in 1925. William and his wife, Elizabeth, worked on the project for 40 years. Friedman was considered one of the greatest cryptographers of his day. He and his team cracked Japan's Code Purple during World War II. But they were never able to figure out the manuscript either. Though Friedman did seem to believe that it might have been an attempt to construct an artificial or universal language.
Hmm.
Robert S. Brumbach, also of Yale University, took a crack at it as well and produced some confusing decipherings that ultimately led nowhere. Hmm. But also Alan Turing apparently took a crack at it as well.
Oh, the king of code breakers.
Yeah, and even Turing couldn't make any sense of it. Now, another interesting case here, in 1987, one Dr. Leo Levitov presented the idea that the book was a liturgical manual for the Cathar religion of the Middle Ages, basically the only surviving document of the Cathar heresy, a sort of Gnostic revival movement that was effectively decimated by the Albigensian crusade of the early 13th century. And much of our understanding of this religion is lost, but Levitov makes the argument that it's a book of Cathar sacraments, including a euthanasia practice.
Whoa.
Or perhaps, you know, a ritualized act of suicide known as Endura.
Which of the illustrations is supposed to show that?
The bathtubs.
Okay.
So, yeah, Levitov argues that we're seeing a discussion of the Vonage in the Vonage of Endura as a rite of ritual opening of the veins and a hot bath as a means of consensually ending one's life in a sacred fashion. And this ties into like ideas of the Cathars believing like that the physical body was inherently you know, debased and therefore like the it's part of you know, the of ensuring that a refined soul you know, travels beyond this plane of being, that sort of thing. But then he also connects Catharism to the worship of the goddess Isis, and he, you know, he believed that that it was not encrypted at all, the manuscript, but it was written in this this, you know, this mixture of medieval Flemish and old French and old High German loan words, all kind of, you know, formed into this amalgamation of language. But while some saw promise in Levitov's argument, there were plenty of people who had numerous problems with it. A big one is that the Endura was definitely a thing. According to Costas Siamis in writing for the Journal of Religion and Health in 2016, quote, "The Endura was the prerequisite act of repentance that allowed the fallen soul to return to heaven, but pretty much everybody agrees that it was basically a fast. It was not a ritual suicide or euthanasia.
Uh-huh.
So another one is this whole ISIS connection. This doesn't pop up anywhere else. And years later, you know, we'd finally get some carbon dating that dismissed, the, you know, the idea that a Bacon origin was possible, and certainly a pre-Bacon origin of the text was equally unlikely or impossible.
Yeah, I'd say that's fairly impossible, given that the vellum was not from before the early 15th century.
Right.
Unless, again, we're dealing with like a copy of an earlier text, which, again, it doesn't necessarily look like.
Now, when we look at other theories as to, you know, where it came from, There have been various, and most of them haven't really endured. There is the interesting notion that 16th century occultist, mathematician, and cryptographer John Dee, along with Edward Kelly, may have been involved with the manuscript in some form or another.
Now, this is McKenna's theory. He's got a complicated argument that yes, it probably was John Dee and Edward Kelly who wrote this document.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. McKenna did present that idea though he also readily admitted that it was just more basically a conjecture on his part, and he had not done a rigorous work to back it up, and there were numerous potential holes in the situation.
Uh-huh. But Kelly and Dee did dabble in they more than dabbled in occult practices. So I mean, it's speculative, but it's not hard to see somebody like John Dee coming up with a strange constructed document that's got kind of magical suggestions in it.
Yeah, we have two older episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind about John Dee that will probably be running as vault episodes here in the immediate future. But he was one of the most brilliant minds of his day. He was involved in cryptography, spycraft, occultism, and mathematics. Edward Kelly, his accomplice here, was an occultist and most agree a con man or a scoundrel of some fashion. Mm-hmm. It's generally described that Edward Kelly's ears were both missing, as punishment for some deed in his past.
Right.
But between the two of them, I often have sort of tried to figure out what is the energy, what is the nature of their collaboration. You know, they're in a way they're a perfect duo, but they're also kind of this strange duo where Dee, there's nobody else like him. And then you wondered to what extent is Kelly taking advantage of the situation? Or is he, able to actually aid Dee in some of his various operations here? But again, the interest in cryptography was there, the interest in occultism. They also both wrote of communication with angels in the Enochian tongue, which we have an alphabet for, by the way, and it is not the Enochian language that we see in the Voynich manuscript.
Okay.
But certainly if you're looking for people at that time period, people who would have been traveling in this area and have had contact with the Holy Roman Emperor, these are two prime suspects.
Yeah. And I do think maybe you were going to get to this in a minute, but I do think it's a decent hypothesis that even if John Dee didn't write this, that John Dee was the source who brought the Voynich manuscript to the Holy Roman Emperor Rudolf II.
Yes. In the book by Benjamin Woolley, The Queen's Conjurer, which is a biography of Dee that I read a few years back for the Stuff to Blow Your Mind episode, the author does mention that Rudolf may well have acquired the manuscript from Dee. But he does not entertain or dismiss the idea that Dee was involved in his production.
Mm.
But he at least acknowledges that it's possible that Dee is the individual who sold it to the emperor. And if that is the case, then we can add one more step, to the beginning of the history of the book. But we still don't know where Dee acquired it.
Right.
So the mystery remains. But John Dee is a fascinating individual. I mean, he is essentially, not only is he the Merlin of the day, mm-hmm. but a lot of our ideas that we associate with the mythical and fictional wizard Merlin kind of stem from Dee.
I think it's believed that he was the inspiration for Shakespeare's Prospero in The mm-hmm. Tempest, right?
Yeah, I've read that as well. He's an astounding figure. To whatever degree he was involved with the Voynich manuscript, there's still plenty of mysterious and wonderful things about Dee himself. For instance, to what extent he was involved in statecraft and worked as a spy. Mm-hmm. There's some that argue that he was totally a spy, and that many of these occult manuscripts that he was peddling around and discussing in occult ideas, they were essentially codes for things.
Mm-hmm.
And others say that no, he was more purely on the occultist end of the spectrum. My read, and I think this has been the read of other commentators, is that it's probably somewhere in between, one of these situations where, he was definitely fascinating with the occult. He was he was a polymath, but being a polymath of the day and one that traveled throughout Europe, he ended up, and also being a devout servant to Elizabeth I, he was more than happy to engage in a little spycraft from time to time.
Another weird connection, I believe John Dee is also supposed to be the inspiration for Christopher Marlowe's incarnation of Dr. Faustus, from of course, who makes a deal with the devil to get all knowledge and, all earthly scientific power. And then Christopher Marlowe, who wrote the English play Dr. Faustus, was also, I believe, involved in statecraft and being a spy.
Fascinating. All right, so there are various other origin stories that we're not going to get into, but just to really drive home how this is still a thing, how people are still not only attempting to crack the Voynich manuscript, but claiming that they did, we should discuss two recent attempts, one extremely recent attempts to crack it that have also fallen short.
Yeah. It seems like there's at least one claim every couple of years that gets picked up by real news sites, and then it always kind of like, oh, no, never mind.
Well, in 2017, we saw just such a case. There was a history researcher and television writer by the name of Nicholas Gibbs, and it was published in the Times Literary Supplement. He believed he'd identified, quote, a common form of medieval Latin abbreviations often used in medical treatises about herbs, and this led him to illustrations in other texts, and he believed resembled those in the Voynich manuscript.
Mm-hmm.
And so this was widely covered, in large part, of course, because it was initially published in the Times Literary Supplement.
Right.
It was picked up by numerous media outlets, including Ars Technica. So initially at Ars Technica, editor Annalie Newitz wrote, quote, this is, again, before it became discredited, quote, Gibbs concluded that it's likely that the Voynich manuscript was a customized book possibly created for one person devoted mostly to women's medicine. Other medieval Latin scholars will certainly want to weigh in, but the sheer mundanity of Gibbs' discovery makes it sound plausible.
Okay. So it's always like it helps you with the claim to have decoded something if the message you decoded is not salacious.
I think it does help the believability, because I think that's ultimately part of the mystery, right?
Right.
And the allure and danger of the mystery is if it is solved, it's not going to be groundbreaking anymore. Like the groundbreaking and the amazing thing about the Voynich manuscript is not that it contains something definite, but that we just have no ability to grasp what it contains.
Right. You'd have to be more suspicious if it says, like, I know the location of the Holy Grail or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But but after this piece came out, then experts began to weigh in, and Newitz also wrote an excellent retraction piece, which citing the various experts who responded to that initial Times Literary Supplement paper.
Mm-hmm.
And the various experts concluded that while they think the text might actually turn out to be a medical treatise on women's health, like that's not impossible, but they think that his translations were not grammatically correct, and that according to Medical Academy of America director Lisa Fagan Davis in The Atlantic, quote, if they had simply sent it to the Benecke Library, they would have rebutted it in a heartbeat.
Yeah, and this is the library at Yale that actually has the Voynich manuscript.
Right.
I think they do Voynich scholarship there.
Right. So I guess that's a little bit of advice out there. If you were an editor potential of any kind of publication and you're potentially publishing something about someone cracking the Voynich manuscript, make a phone call, send an email to the Benecke Library and see if you can get somebody to weigh in on it before you publish.
Yeah, I think that would be a smart move. Now, have there been any cases this year?
Yes, in 2019. This one popped up. You might have seen this headline. Bristol academic cracks Voynich code, solving century-old mystery of medieval text. And yeah, I remember seeing this one. I want to say that it even popped up on a fairly notable science release website that I use, but then was later removed.
Hmm.
Dr. Gerard Cheshire, research assistant at Bristol University, claimed that it was a therapeutic reference book written in a lost language called Proto-Romance. And this article appeared on the university's website, but then was later taken down after experts chimed in and questioned the validity of the research.
Ooh.
And there hasn't been an additional follow-up on that, but it would seem to be the case that there's another situation where someone thought they'd cracked it and they had not. That they had perhaps, in the words of Mary D'Imperio, recreated the same steps and missteps of those that came before trying to crack the Voynich manuscript.
Yeah.
And of course, in addition to this, like we've said, there's just a lot of baseless speculation surrounding the manuscript online.
It features into historical conspiracy theories.
Yeah, you'll find it on YouTube. You'll find it on various Reddit boards. According to Raymond Clemens, a curator of early books and manuscripts at the Benecke Library, one of the most fun examples that they've run across is that the Voynich manuscript is the work of an alien visitor to Earth from the Andromeda galaxy who was making notes about our planet and then dropped their notebook before they return.
Well, wait, why would it be notes about our planet if none of the plants can be identified?
Maybe alien eye vision, is weird. I don't know. Yeah. Maybe they were. There are a lot of holes in this theory, Joe, is what I'm saying.
Yeah. All right, we need to take one more break, but we'll be right back with more.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon. Just $25 a month, every month. Taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
What kind of fun is waiting for you at Kings Island? The, holy cow, we're way too high and here comes the drop kind of fun. The, make a splash all summer kind of fun. The, I can't believe I ate that whole funnel cake. Let's get another kind of fun. But most importantly, at Kings Island, you'll find for the fun of it kind of fun.
Don't wait to start your fun season. Kings Island is now open on weekends.
All right, we're back. Now, we've talked about evidence going in both directions of people who just try to look at the text statistically or mathematically as a text and say, does it look like a text in a real language, even coded in a real language? Mm-hmm. And the answer there is some indications kind of point to yes and some indications kind of point to no. I think one thing I wanted to look at now is something that was pointed out in that Skeptical Inquirer article by Klaus Schmeh. He pointed out some interesting research from the early 2000s by the British linguist Gordon Rugg.
So I'm just going to read this section from Schmee's article. Schmee writes, quote, "The British linguist Gordon Rugg is among the most reputable Voynich researchers. He conducted a most interesting cryptological experiment. For his experiment, Rugg generated a table with random combinations of characters that he used as prefixes, roots, or suffixes of new words. He positioned a quadratic stencil like the one used for encryption in the 16th century over the table. In this manner, he obtained a sequence of letters that bore great resemblance to the text of the Voynich manuscript. Rugg's experiment supports the hypothesis that the manuscript is nothing but a compilation of meaningless lines and letters," which is, of course, the hoax hypothesis. And then Schmee also points out a study by the Austrian physicist Andreas Schinner that also supports the idea that even though there are some things about this that do look like a text, it's possible, like a real text in a real natural language, it's possible to generate a text like this without it being based on a real language. And Schinner's analysis, I think, was primarily based on the fact that there are unnatural regularities in the order of words appearing in the manuscript that don't mirror sequences of words that appear in real languages. So I don't think that completely settles it, but that's more fuel back on the fire of the side that says, okay, this is just a hoax document or glossolalia or something that somebody made up and doesn't correlate to real words that make sense.
But and then ultimately this, yeah, this gives credence to just the, its power to break those that desperately seek to find meaning in it.
Yeah.
Like it just kind of, it almost seems like it does point people to the, you know, near the threshold of madness where they make that leap and they say, I've done it. I figured it out and believe that they have, you know, I mean, none of the individuals that we've named here, you know, from the Voynich manuscripts, you know, recent history, you know, I don't think any of them have, you know, have been trying to pull anything over on anyone. I think they've reached a point where they genuinely think they found the clue. They found, you know, the missing piece that has enabled us to understand this document.
Well, as satisfying as it is to solve a puzzle, it is equally maddening to work on a puzzle without solving it. Mm-hmm. And I think that can kind of drive people. It creates unreasonable incentives in the mind to toil over a puzzle or a code for so long without breaking it. Like the desire to have broken it becomes incredibly strong.
I will say this. One lesson I've taken home from all of this is friends don't let friends claim they've cracked the Voynich manuscript.
That's right.
If you know somebody and they're like, hey, you know, I think I've translated the Voynich manuscript. I'm going public with this tomorrow. You know, talk them down from that. Ask them just to settle down a little and rethink before you go public with this new translation.
I just want to say, though, this is not conclusive from that interesting article by Schmee about his conclusion. Just his opinion is that it's very likely it's possible that it's a hoax. Of course, he thinks the author was probably an anonymous artist living in the first half of the 1400s. And if it is actually encrypted, one thing he points to that I think is interesting is he says it's easier to encrypt a text if the encrypted text generates far more characters than the original text. So if a 50,000 character original document was encrypted in a way that generates 170,000 characters, then it's easier to see how it could still be hiding its meaning, right? If there are tons of characters in there that don't code out to anything, like how do you separate the coding letters from the filler letters? Mm-hmm. So that's a possible explanation for if there is a code in there, why it hasn't been cracked yet. Another thing that he does find plausible is he finds it plausible that this is an artificial created language. Somebody just made up a language of their own, and that's why it doesn't translate to anything else. Mm. Based on what I've read, that also seems plausible to me. I can imagine this being, I don't know, a language unique to one person who was, you know, toiling away in their turret or something, yeah, in a monastery, or maybe shared by a small number of people for some kind of esoteric purpose or, yeah, some kind of occult purpose, maybe.
Absolutely.
But the key being, if it's an invented language rather than a code for an existing language, that would explain why it doesn't code out.
Well, whatever its origins, whatever its meaning or lack of meaning, it continues to enthrall us and perplex us. And I'd likely will continue to do so. I do not expect that we'll reach the point where we need to, you know, add, there may be additional, you know, arguments, some new ideas that are brought up, but I am not expecting to see anybody crack this in the future.
Yeah, I will say, as much as I would like to see it cracked, the walls of my skeptical fortress here have been fortified. And I now, when I see an article, as they do tend to pop up once every year or two, an article about how somebody has cracked the Voynich manuscript, I think now I will probably conclude, okay, I bet that's not right.
Right. And then, but then another thing about it too is like, if it was cracked, the magic would be gone. Like the part of the whole reason that we're enthralled by this document is that we don't know what its meaning or meaninglessness really consists of.
Well, it's like how, you know, the best part of a mystery is always the middle. It's almost never the end.
Yeah.
When you get to the end and you find out who done it, it's almost always disappointing.
Yeah, because there are only so many ways it can go, right? Yeah.
I'd say, actually, though, to tie it back to the subject, one of the only counterexamples I can think of is The Name of the Rose, where the solution of the mystery is supremely satisfying.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there's a strong case to be made there. Yeah. Interesting, too, the other mystery book that I mentioned, The Club Dumas by Perez Reverta, also a mystery. That's the book that The Ninth Gate was based on.
Okay.
And it's been a while since I've seen The Ninth Gate, but I definitely remember enjoying the book. It's a fun little, you know, occult-themed thriller.
No, I've never read it. I should check that out. How's the ending?
Pretty good, as I recall.
Yeah.
It's different from the movie, again, based on my fading memory of it. But I'd love to close out here with one more quote from that Terence McKenna piece from 1998 from Gnosis Magazine, which I think he sums up a lot of the power and the our fascination with this document. He said, quote, "It is a kind of Borgesian concept that there must be somewhere an unreadable book, and perhaps this is it. The unreadable book hints at the idea that the world is in information. We have cognizance of the world by ordering all of the information we come upon in relation to information that we have already accumulated through patterns. An unreadable book in a non-English script with no dictionary attached is very puzzling. We become like linguistic oysters. We secrete around it. We insist it into our metaphysics, but we don't know what it says, which always carries with it the possibility that it says something that would unhinge our conceptions of things, or that its real message is its unreadability. It points to the otherness of the nature of information, and is what is called in structuralism a limit text. Certainly the Voynich manuscript is the limit text of Western occultism. It is truly an occult book, one that no one can read."
The literal meaning of a cult.
Yeah.
It's a mystery in the dark.
Absolutely. All right. So there you have it. The Voynich manuscript. Obviously, we'd love to hear from everybody out there because...
have you cracked it?
Have you cracked it? It's very possible we will hear from someone who believes that they have. Or at the very least, perhaps you can turn us on to some other wild theories, some of the crazier theories that we didn't get into, involving its origin. There were some other ones we didn't discuss and what involving like the various other like occult conspiracy theories.
The Rosicrucians and stuff. McKenna talks about that.
Yeah. So certainly if you have any of those ideas you want to chat with us about, you can reach out to us. In the meantime, check out more episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind at stufftoblowyourmind.com. And make sure that you have subscribed to the podcast. Make sure you subscribe to Invention as well. Invention is our step-by-step journey through human techno history. And you can find that at inventionpod.com. Wherever you listen to our shows, just make sure that you have rated and reviewed them because that helps us out immensely.
Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producers, Maya Cole and Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, to show us your code to your method of decoding the Voynich manuscript, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. We'll be right back.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.
What kind of fun is waiting for you at Kings Island? The holy cow, we're way too high and here comes the drop kind of fun. The make a splash all summer kind of fun. The I can't believe I ate that whole funnel cake. Let's get another kind of fun. But most importantly, at Kings Island, you'll find for the fun of it kind of fun.
Don't wait to start your fun season. Kings Island is now open on weekends.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.